Welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. Here, we speak with extraordinary games industry professionals and listen to their story to learn all about what they've built and who they are. GamesNet Berlin Europe is the international games industry initiative of MediaNet Berlin Brandenburg, the networking association for the media, creative and digital industries in Germany's capital region. My name is Simon Oler, and I will be your host for this program. Today, we are speaking with, or should I say, traveling, with Steffen P. Walz. Steffen has had many jobs and titles, and today he is an explorer at Diconium, a Volkswagen subsidiary. He cares about health and resilience, automotive and games. We start at the beginning, and Steffen takes us on his journey through his life. A truly remarkable life with stops like map drawer, satire TV writer, musician, random meetings on trains haver, location-based game maker, founding professor of a games program at university, and so on. Through his seemingly chaotic story shines one guiding principle, his inner compass that he follows, and of course, the pleasure to play. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy our conversation with Steffen P. Walz.
Hello and welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast with my beautiful co-host Simon.
Hello, thank you.
And our guest today is Steffen P. Walz, a man living in Berlin and having some of the weirdest job titles that I've ever seen from people. So it's very hard to give this intro some kind of underlying structure. But I will just reference those titles from the ones that I find the most conventional to the most unconventional. So this is how I rank Steffen's titles. He is a freelancer, a consultant, a lecturer, a professor, a managing director / co-founder, a chief design director, also a chief design dude. That's something different, apparently. He's a collectivist / co-initiator, a resiliencer, and an explorer. And this is his current main gig at Diconium Digital Solutions, which is a Volkswagen company. This is a podcast about games, so there must be something to it. But yeah, some of these titles sound a little bit more like classes in an RPG than titles for a job description, but Steffen will tell us all about what these are about. So let's start. Hi, Steffen. How are you?
I'm good. Hello. How are you guys?
Doing well.
Very good. And considering that maybe classes in an RPG are maybe the same as job titles in that thing we call real life. But yeah, Steffen, please let us know.
It's funny that we start with this because there are somewhat a kind of a look, view into the past, I guess, because most of those are no longer my job titles, but they tell a career story, you could say. And what's clearly the pattern there is most of them I've chosen myself. They weren't given, they weren't awarded.
That's very good.
Yes, I like that too. And yeah, I mean, we could pick one. Do you want to pick one? And then Florian, and then I'll talk about that.
Yeah, we will just start as we usually start. First of all, I will ask you if I forgot something that is even more interesting than these, or if I caught the most interesting ones. And
I'm a parent. I'm a dad.
Oh yes, true. Yes.
That's not a job title per se, but it's rather.
But it's a title. Best dad, number one dad.
Oh, that is up to the daughters to decide. I would hope. Hope sometimes. Sometimes, yes, maybe. Not always. Not in the everyday. You know.
Yeah. What's on your mind at the moment, or what are you working on at the moment? That's how we usually start.
I see. So that would go together with the job title of an explorer. Because that's how I have come to call myself in the context of Diconium, who you mentioned are a Volkswagen subsidiary, or to be more precise, a subsidiary of Cariad. Cariad being the software development house within Volkswagen, spanning all brands that you are probably aware of that belong to Volkswagen: Audi, Porsche, Bentley, Lamborghini, etc., 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 and VW, of course. And CARIAD themselves are a 100% daughter, obviously, of the Volkswagen Group, and we as Diconium are a 100% subsidiary of CARIAD.
And now, CARIAD is CARIAD. Just kind of Google that.
Correct.
CARIAD
.technology is the URL. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're building the next generation of operating systems for cars. We're also building, functionalities around autonomous driving, and this is why I'm here. Well, parts of it at least. We're also looking at the role of gaming and interactive entertainment in the context of mobility. And being an explorer at Diconium, I choose topics that I sort of go scout, you could say. So, you know, people who go out and look at new startups and topics that are arising, new interesting technologies, interesting communities. Now, I do this quite a bit, but my main focus there is always to look at it through the lens of content. And I explore, and well, because I like exploring. That says a few things about my character. I'm an explorer. Not so much a warrior, or maybe not so much socializer. I can socialize, but I like exploring more. And in my current role, I go seek out new ventures and new types of innovations, not always related to games, oftentimes related to questions of, commerce and, yes, of course, mobility. I've been looking quite a bit at the topic of health and well-being in the context of mobility. And that's what I have been doing in the past 3 and a little bit years in my main job.
Mm-hmm. So as the connoisseurs of games and the games industry have figured out by now, your field is what we usually refer to as serious games, or in other terms, also the gamification of processes, right?
Parts, I would say. I have been in the serious games field for a long, long time, having built all kinds of serious games. Some of them sucked. A few were pretty good, I would think, and nailed things in the health sector in specific. But I wouldn't consider myself to be just a serious games guy, because I also look for places where games have not yet taken a hold.
Mm-hmm.
Such as, it could be vehicles, it could be installations, it could be all kinds of places. So the exploration part of things, to come back to that job title, has a lot to do, in my reading, with looking for ways of how and spaces and contexts and, situations and communities where content and games can take on a new role, or where they haven't been established yet. And in this regard, I wouldn't just call myself a serious games guy. I can give you an example what that means. So in the context of automobility, I many years ago, almost, I think 8 years ago or so, we started to ask how could we bring virtual reality to moving vehicles. And mm-hmm. why? Well, because we thought it would be cool and interesting. And then we created something out of that, which is clearly not a serious game, but a platform, a spin-off out of Audi called HoloRide. And so that's not a serious game. That's a games platform for letting people experience mobility coupled with game and under other entertainment experiences. So a little bit like an entertainment ride in a car, you could say. But interactive.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oh, this is going to be so fun, because you already, through this whole intro, there are so many threads, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And we thought of you in our preparation today, and we were like, well, hey, man, let's just tell this whole story. And you said it in the beginning that these job titles are also a timeline. So I'm going to bring us to the beginning now, to the very beginning, and then I'm sure there will be, it will, this interview will be also a platform, so you can tell all the stories that, that you deem relevant, but with where they come from.
Yeah, sure.
Ready to play this game?
Sure, I'm ready. Let's do it.
Nice. Let's start at the beginning, Steffen. Where did you grow up? How did you grow up? And who were your parents, if you want to get into that? And
absolutely.
What happened to you? What were you like? And all the stories that belong to that.
Thank you for this question. Actually, I had for a while, I didn't want to really, I guess, reflect on where I come from so much. But then I, over the years, I came to realize that this actually kind of tells my story in a really cool way. And so I'll share with you that my mom, I grew up in Sindelfingen, nearby Stuttgart, one of the key plants for Mercedes-Benz, for Daimler. My dad was a worker, a fine mechanic, as a tradesmanship at Mercedes for, oh man, I think over 40 years. He was there for a long time. He was one of the classical guys who, you know, just joins the company at an early age and then just stays with them forever. So we were a Mercedes family, you know, like many others in town. And my mom was a nurse and a medical practitioner. And as such, it's interesting because two of the key fields that I've been looking at quite a lot in my career have to do with mobility and with health, questions of health and mobility and the convergences thereof. And I brought the angle of games and entertainment in.
Nice.
So
the new thing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
In between. Yeah, okay.
It's totally rooted in, I can tell you, I mean, we took really long road trips. We're going every year, would drive to Spain by car.
By Benz, I assume?
Yes, of course.
what type? I had this question on my mind. What, I love cars, so mm-hmm. What were the models that appeared?
Oh my God, 128er, 123er, these are the model rides. So we had a 200, 220D, we had a 190E when it came out, always limousines. Yeah. My dad, he was so proud. there was something they called they called it an auction, where when they released the SL car, if you remember.
SLK, the Roadster, yeah?
The Roadster, yes. My dad entered into an auction, an internal auction, but the auction was not to win the car, but to win the right to purchase the car.
Uh-huh.
Yes, because it was, you know, constrained and there was restrictions in terms of how many of those vehicles could be bought by people who were working for Mercedes. And he won. And this was, I remember my dad being so happy because also, I mean, this was how many families lived in Sindelfingen. You would buy the car and then you would sell it, right? And because of the rebate that you got as a worker there, you would make money.
Uh-huh.
And that's what many families did. And so my dad got the SLK. And then I was like, oh, Dad, let's go for a ride. It would be so cool in there in the Roadster, la la. And he was like, nope, it's going to sit in the garage for 1 year, Jahreswagen, the annual vehicle. Yeah. And then I'm going to sell it. And I want it to be mint.
Nice.
And I was like, uh-uh. And he was like, mm-hmm. and I was like, please, begging, you know. And I will tell you, in the end, before he sold it, on the day, we took a ride.
Yes. Nice.
And it was a beautiful red SLK Roadster that I really loved a lot. And so that's the typical thing that you got when you were growing up there in Sindelfingen.
And so just that's for the precursor. Sorry, real quick, just to wrap it up. If you want to Google the imagery here, W128 Benz, W123 Benz,
correct,
190D Benz, yes. Yes. And SLK red. Yes. And then you will find all the cars referenced.
And the original SLK, if I may say. So it was the first one that they released. But to finish this thread, we took these long road trips because my mom came from Hamburg. And every year, maybe 3-4 times a year, we'd travel to Hamburg. And I remember those road trips to have been extremely boring, 7, 8, 9 hours. And we took them regularly because it was really important, of course, for my mom to see her family. And my dad, we loved Hamburg, and I still love Hamburg quite a lot, and had a big connection there. And also traveling to Spain. So those trips were when I thought I fantasized. I always was a dreamer, clearly. I dreamed myself into, fantasy. Early on, I remember going to the library in Sindelfing, and there was a lady, the librarian, Miss Fritz, who I held still. She's one of the reasons why I started to love reading and to go into fantasy and science fiction. And then I was quite young. I can't remember how old I was, probably maybe 11, 10, 11. And I walked up to her and I said, Miss Fritz, do you have books that are really like not just regular novels, but novels that sort of take you to other places where you can travel to other places? And she looked at me and she said, ah, you mean fantasy? And I said, yeah, maybe, I don't know. And I think you mean science fiction too. And I was like, that could be. And she introduced me to Holbein.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
to Avalon. And so these were my, and to, of course, all kinds of other stuff. But and this was also for me, because she said, you might be too young for this. And Tolkien, of course, and not The Hobbit, but the real deal. and this was, I remember exactly that this was a point in my life where I thought, now I'm a grown-up because I'm reading books that grown-ups read, but I was only 10 or 11. So I started inhaling, sucking in these books a lot. So this combination of my love of going traveling to other places, but also traveling itself, because I think traveling is an eternal dream that we've got. But when we think of traveling right now, we oftentimes think of it as physical travel, but it's virtual travel, like playing games, hanging out in other places. That's virtual mobility, right, to me. So when I sat in during those road trips, I thought, I really want to go these places, but how can I do that? So that and my deep interest in health and well-being through my mom and other family members, I think this is sort of my defining me, I guess.
Yeah, that's quite a mix. And and it does indeed tell the story, right? Like you said.
Yeah. Mm.
So processing that. So then you read books and you were dreaming around. And
drawing maps. I drew a lot of maps. Lots. All the time. Like of fantasy places, cities. This is when I discovered that I love placemaking, which I also think is one of the fundamental things that you do when you create new places, and you create the rules of the world, yes, but also how the place comes across, how you can explore it. Here again, the explorer side, map drawing was a big deal for me. Like, I made up these places. There's nothing that I know, like my partner, for example, she played Ultima a lot with her dad. And they would, like so many early role-playing game people, they would draw maps, she'd tell me. I mean, didn't know her back in the day, of course, but she, we're a game family, so... She talks about this quite a bit when she would sit down with her dad and they would, draw Ultima maps, etc. And I did that, but I just made up my own places of my own. I don't know where all those maps are.
Yeah, would be cool to know. That's like there's like an Instagram account or whatever that just wants these maps. And so you and your partner are both map drawers?
No more.
Well, originally, yeah.
I would think so, yes. I think that's something that's surely something that we share, is our love of entertainment and fantasy and science fiction. We cherish that, yes.
And speaking of making spaces, making places, can you tell us what that means for you and how you use that in what you do in your work, and maybe which class is it corresponding with?
Which, I like that RPG metaphor. That's interesting. Well, there were different times in my life when I thought of this as being architecture, and that games and every game has architecture, which is true, right? Yes. So you have a backdrop, you have elements in a given game environment that can serve architectural purposes. They can be hindrances, they can be gates, they can be doors, they can be leeways, they can be, expressways, all kinds of things that you can think of how architecture and, even more concretely so, the notion of urbanism or the notion of space making, as in it becomes a city that you can, traverse and that you're in. The game takes place in a city, so to speak. That these can all be aspects. But to come back to your question, how do I look at it? I think this is a question around designing, right? Games or situations.
Yeah. Games and situations. Man, okay. So I'm on a whole trip right now about choosing your own games. This week I had a total breakthrough in my own thinking. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because I just see this thread now. Maybe it's on your mind as well. But in some things you already said, it's like dreaming your own worlds and, trying to make things less boring and like choosing your own job titles. I'm like, oh man, this guy is on a choosing his own games trip, right? Like, he's a game maker. He makes and for me, this is right now like a whole pattern of, I just realized I need to bring way more of my own games into the world because I'm often bored with other people's games, so to speak.
Everyone is a game maker, Simon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. I'm realizing this right now. So
everyone is. We are all. Sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, please. Go.
No, go ahead.
Just to say, where's this question coming from? I was thinking about exactly that. And then I know that you are hosting workshops, for example, where you draw up scenarios. And I know you're trying to come up with, some form of games or fantasy lands that come up in your car work. And I'm sure you've designed some games that are more gamey or maybe serious games that do the same. And so I wanted to ask you, well, there seems to be like this type of game making, map drawing, rule setting. And so, yeah, that's where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to bring that connection or for you to bring that connection from this original drawing maps and thinking up games and plays to... Because I think many kids or youngsters, for example, do that. And then, well, how do you put that into work? And my feeling is that that is really a very much a cornerstone of like a lot of entrepreneurial and creative
activity. Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah, so that's the question.
100%. I think that we, and this is where space comes in, but also other aspects, such as what is the situation that you find, the social situation, right? And very, if you look at it, I guess, through a more defined or gamey lens, you could say, well, what are the kinds of controllers that they've got? Are they seated? All kinds of what we might call experience design questions, right? Or user experience design questions. Mm-hmm. But if you widen this up and you look at it entrepreneurially, and also, as you said, I look at it as a direct trajectory from my being a child and growing up and wanting to see those worlds that I dream up, and not just myself, but together with others, because it's teamwork oftentimes, right? And facilitate for others to be able to dream up that stuff. And that it roots in our capability to be imagining and dreaming up. And as I said at the beginning, traveling to places, to alternate worlds, but also to maybe travel through into the lives of other people. Social media is like kind of traveling to people's socialness, if that's a word.
For better and for worse.
For worse. Indeed. Or traveling through time is another thing that's been with us for so long, right? If you look at Lascaux, at the cave paintings, kind of, I mean, without having talked to these people in a proper interview and user evaluation, but we can assume that they put these drawings and these almost, you could even say, maps of the hunt onto the walls so they would memorize and also be able to pass on knowledge, but in a way they also traveled back in time to when the hunt took place. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for traveling through space. So that's what mobility is all about. You travel through space and time, right? And that's what space travel is about. And many tropes that you find in games are bound to that, right? Traveling to some kind of, you know, speeding up time, slowing down time, making time obsolete, all kinds of stuff. And the same is true for space. So when you ask me that question entrepreneurially, I would say, in a way, I think that we need to be allowing for ourselves and everyone the fact that it's okay, and not only okay, but deeply humane, that we dream up and travel to these other places. Mm-hmm. That is, to me, something, and without knowing too much about animal studies, because I know that, you know, apes and chimpanzees, they probably think alike. But one core thing that we are really good at humans is exactly that. We can think and project ourselves into other situations.
Yeah.
Past, future, present, alternate worlds, etc. And this is what drives me as an entrepreneur, has always been, I want to break new ground with that. And in my little, in my life, my little segment of things, I think that this is driving me totally. I love to explore. There we go again, and start out. And maybe one sentence about space as a founding principle. It's not always that I use space as a starting point, like in workshops or etc. But I think it's really to do with asking, what do you need minimally to orchestrate an experience for someone else? Because you don't design the experience, you frame it.
Yep.
The experience is what then happens when people do play or do the thing that you have sort of framed, right? The activity. Mm-hmm. And I think that entrepreneurs are doing exactly that. They say, here's something new, hopefully new. I like new. I like innovative. And this is what we thought up. Yeah, hopefully you tested it too with people before you go to market or wherever. And this is for you to explore something that's follows certain rules that probably and most likely are not the rules that we experience here in our everyday.
Mm-hmm.
And entrepreneurs, even with design products or whatever, you know, like a new functionality. I mean, isn't it so? This is, I want to ask you guys what you think. Isn't it so that, let's say, Apple introduces a new interesting functionality, and then you're like, oh, wow, I never thought of this this way, and it's so elegant and so smooth, right? So this is kind of the legacy Apple that I'm talking about. but this is also making up something and coming up with something that is taking, that opens the perception to how things could be done, and all of a sudden it's there. So I think that, isn't that, don't you agree? So it's almost like, oh wow, that's something that was, yes, you can hypothesize that something will happen, right? One plus B, yeah, or A plus B, yeah, that will come. That's the typical thing that also happens in creativity studies. You know, you converge things, you recontextualize things, et cetera, but coming up with something new and then taking people by the hand or letting them experience that new thing, that is truly entrepreneurial. And that, games to me, are a way to break new ground.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me in this is the dynamic between people. In a way, we usually have guests on the podcast who are very entrepreneurial spirits. Most of them have started their own companies. They, of course, most of them have a connection to games. Maybe they started their own game studio or whatever. But in any of these cases, when it comes to the entrepreneurial spirit, there's always this task of why do you start this company or why do you create this game? Do you, I mean, if it's in games, very often the question is not, I want to solve this specific problem, or I think that people will need this game to do something. When we are talking about the entertainment process, it's usually more about like, I think this mechanic is something that people haven't seen yet, or I think this art style, whatever, this game design is something that would bring a new experience that people haven't received that or haven't perceived that yet. So this thinking about what kind of people will go into these spaces and start a company, start a game to deliver this experience or this product to people, what does it take for a person to have that in them? Like, what's the driving factor to get them to this point? And what connects these people in a way? Are the motivations always the same? Mm-hmm. Could I, for example, thinking about my own life, thinking about what interests me, would I consider myself an entrepreneur? Would I start a company, for example? Would I be able to create the game that would interest people? Those are questions that interest me when we are talking about this. So yeah, that's my input. Put on that. So if you have any answers to that?
First off, I would say it doesn't always have to be a company. It can just be for, you know, us. We could make up something that we like, and then it probably even doesn't matter if we call it a game. You know, there's so many people who are so keen on being very precise what a game is and what it isn't. In a way, I don't care, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are hard definitions, but so what? If you want to market it that way, all right, fair enough. But I think it's really more to come back to what you said about entrepreneurialism. I guess, yes, mechanic, that can be a starting point. I think I am almost a little bit obsessed about social situations and spatial situations and sort of the given circumstances of a situation, mm-hmm. because I am also a social scientist. So you typically start out by asking that question, like what's happening, what's there, right? And mm-hmm. also because when you take games to new places, then there is already stuff happening there. It's not the living room, right? It's not a very dedicated gaming situation where you sit down and you play the console and everything around you doesn't matter. But usually then, let's say primary activities in the car, you know, I mean, when you're a passenger, you are seated in a certain way and there's certain things happening. Very classical design questions, experience design, product design, that kind of stuff. And psychological questions, you know, you're in a constrained space. You share the space for temporarily with other people, unless you're by yourself, et cetera, et cetera. So I've always liked those challenges. And I don't look at them as challenges, but as opportunities. And this is where the entrepreneurial spirit comes in again, because then I say, well, if people are doing certain things, and it's not just about breaking the boredom, but it's really more asking, how can you take advantage of something that's already there? And to me, these are questions that are then almost intimately tied to the question also, yes, of how the game itself takes place, or the experience takes place, right? How is it designed mechanically? How do you involve people? So I think, and this is maybe because I've also been, I mean, I did my PhD in architecture or in computer-aided architectural design. I look at things rather spatially, but also as a, you know, as technological setups, socio-technological setups. And I don't only look at them, which probably differentiates me from others, just for the pure question of, hey, I want to make a game and I want to sell it. Hopefully people will play it. That's great. I'm not sure if that's true, but I'll say it. I think that I also sometimes want to think more of, unless we design a serious game, more of what is the platform, so to speak, right? What's the yeah, as I said, the given circumstances. And I am very interested. I've designed location-based games. Very good example, I guess, where, yeah, you wander around in the city and there's traffic and there's, you know, passers-by and other pedestrians, la, la, la. So there's situations where games take place where other stuff is happening. So I've always been fascinated by that. I can say that for sure.
So I wanted to move it on to what you studied, because we came from map drawing and spaces as like a youth hobby. What happened to you in school or something to a degree, and how did you move towards your, I assume, I don't know this exactly, correct me, but I assume you went a regular route from school to studies. Mm-hmm. So yes. What happened there and what did you do?
Well, I think before I did my Abitur, what was really defining for me was I was in a band.
Nice.
And we were part of the grunge movement, I suppose you could say that. We started out as a Matani cover band. Anyone knows this band still. Sort of
very tiny bell, Matani.
Matani, no, yes. Superfuzz Big Muff. And I'm currently just looking at a photograph that I got from one of the iconographic photographer of the time in Seattle, Charles Johnson, who did take all these pictures. And there's all these Kurt Cobain Nirvana pictures that you know, black and white, super life scenes that are frozen where there's lots of hair and lots of stuff happening. And so I love this kind of style. Anyways, but I was 15, maybe 14, 15, 16, I can't remember. And we started out this cover band with Mudhoney and Beastie Boys covers and then Nirvana too, early Nirvana. And we met bands and we toured all of a sudden with Green Day, you know.
What?
Yeah, totally. Yes.
Dude, you toured with Green Day?
Yeah.
What? That's fucking sick, bro. What?
Yeah. I got nastily drunk with them, not once, but a lot, several times. And we did things in, Backnang in nearby Stuttgart. I can't tell you. I'm not going to say what, but things that we...
You did things, yeah?
Things with an Einkaufswagen, with a trolley.
I can see a little Billy Joe in a little trolley.
But, you know, this was the tour that they played before they broke. The break had their breakthrough, because was just when they played Jugendhäuser. and other bands we played a lot. We released songs, etc. So I've always been I think what you can say about me is that I always was so interested in different types of entertainment. Mm-hmm. Music.
Hey, what was your band called?
From Outer Space.
From Outer Space, nice. Yeah, mm-hmm. good grungy name. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we released a few thingies, a few records. You can still, I guess, get as, you know, collector's items. And that was really important to me for a long time. This is also when I think the whole game thing wasn't so, or I didn't know that I wanted to be a game dude. I thought I might become a director, to be honest, like a, you know, film director. I also did a bit of short film production and writing when I used to live in the US for a little bit. So music, writing. I was a satire journalist actually for a while, for television satire for something that then became known in the end as Polylux, which for a while was a late night satire format that ran in the IRD. And we did the precursor in what was called the ORB. Was it ORB? I think it was ORB. What today is Radio Berlin Brandenburg, RBB.
RBB.
The former RBB. And we did a thing that was called Tip TV. So Tip is used to be, I think, are they still around? God, this is almost embarrassing, but is Tip still around? It's like the, you know, when we, which you would buy, the magazine that you'd buy in the olden days to look up what's on.
I think
it the could TV program.
No.
As an event. Going on in the city.
City. What's on in the city?
Yeah. It's probably online at this point.
Maybe. Yeah, yeah. I vaguely remember that they had to sell the business. I can't remember. It doesn't matter. So TIP had their own format, television format, and it was called TIP TV, and we had satire segments in there. So I had done an internship at Arabella. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. It's not name dropping. It's just my life.
No, it's just.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. To understand what that even means and to know what that references, you have to be so deep in German television history. Yes, that it's
very,
like,
very deeply.
I don't know how many of our listeners will understand, but we link to everything that we talk about.
Yes, please do. Arabella Kiesbauer. Yes. She had a television format and talk show format, and I worked there for a bit, and then I met this guy who was part of TIP TV, who drove around on a Schwalbe, a moped, Eastern German brand, he would dress up as a 1920s reporter, called himself Der Rasende Reporter. So I became a writer for the Rasende Reporter segment and for other segments in TIP TV. And so I did satire writing for a while, and then I studied too in Tübingen, and I studied social sciences and rhetoric and empirische Kulturwissenschaft, which is the study of the everyday. And this is when, after I'd done all this other stuff, and I did still play music, had a little kind of a hit as under the name of Steffen Strom with a song called Angie, which is the name of my ex girlfriend,
correct number of exes, I assume.
I didn't count. It's good. I did when I was saying it. I was like, "Oh God, is this really true?" And if my partner hears this, she's going to go, "What?"
Sure. Yeah.
What? No. Who is it? Who? I don't know. And so this was the culmination of my music career, where we had the song Angie as Steffen Strom.
Really, this was covered by the Rolling Stones later, right?
Actually, no, it's influenced by that song. That's pretty funny. It has a reference in the lyrics. It's a German lyric song. It has a reference to the Stones song. Angie hat gesagt, I can't say it anymore. It doesn't matter. Anyways, look, what happened is someone at the Greens heard the song, and this was the 2004 federal elections in Germany. And I had a really good friend who was friends with, key figures in the Green Party in Germany. And then they heard the song and they were like, "Hey, would you consider to rewrite that song?"
Mm-hmm.
Like, write it so that... And I was like, "Yeah, maybe, I don't know." And then I kind of sort of felt that it would be cool. And so I wrote a satirical song around, but not hurtful, mocking, right?
Yeah.
Because, I despise of things that are just in the face. Like, there are so many songs these days that are like that, but that's a different story. Mm-hmm. So I wrote the song about Angela Merkel and then the Greens put it out in 2004 for the elections, and it got downloaded quite a lot of times. And that was my, and then I remember I was sitting in a cafe in Berlin, and we talked about, can you, play at all the big, press events and all that. And I didn't want that. Mm-hmm. I just wanted, I was happy with the song as it was. And I was, of course, happy with all the downloads that we got, but I didn't want to become sort of the
poster boy.
Exactly. I didn't want to be the poster boy. And so that was also the time that exactly the moment where I decided I'm no longer going to be in the music thing, because it's really not my thing. And because I'm too introvert for that sometimes. I just need my, I didn't feel like it. So anyways, cut a long story short, that's when I actually was nearing in on my master's, my thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I then had always this thing about, games. They were always there. I played them. You might have noticed, I played Ultima 2. I played stuff. And then I was a tech boy, always had been sort of like a little hacker, doing things, building things, soldering things. I just like that. And I've always been a bit of a messy person too, with collecting things, comics and stuff. And I don't know, I'm just weird that way. and so I met someone on the train.
That's how the best stories start.
Yeah, these are the best stories. Actually, I was traveling to Berlin, where I live today. And so there's this guy on the train who's got a handheld, a Palm Pilot. We're talking, this is kids out there, this is a long time ago, and grandfather will tell you about so early Palm Pilot stuff. And so he sat there, and it was probably 1 o'clock, and he was drinking wine. And as a young, wild person coming directly out of, music, I was like, cool, Palm Pilot, how do you like it, lala. So we started to talk. And this is Raoul Heinkel. If you listen to this, mate, so this I really loved. I remember this with the fondest of hearts, really. It was such a cool day. And we started to drink heavily. Oh, man. Oh, man, did we drink. And we talked.
This podcast is going off the rails.
And, you know, I mean, yeah. It was,
while we are on the train.
Whilst we were on the train traveling to Berlin. And then he was like, hey, you know, I am part of this, group of people at ZKM. Now, ZKM is the media arts museum that's based in Karlsruhe. And I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, I know people too, because I had been sort of involved in kind of media arts a little bit with people in Stuttgart. And so we had people who we, you know, shared, who we knew each other. And then out of this conversation and of, you know, the sort of train partying, he invited me to a party. We went on it, like, I think we partied for 3 days hardcore. It was really hot, hardcore. And then he invited me and said, I'm with those ZKM people, I'm setting up a new program called Mobile Application Design. Now, we talk at the Zurich University of the Arts. And this was, we're talking about a time when there were no smartphones. There was Nokia phones that were somewhat intelligent. There was Palm Pilots, that kind of stuff. Compaq, Compaq had really cool, those I love, the Compaq, which would then become HP. They had really cool Palm Pilots with touch interfaces and color displays and all that stuff. And with a sort of like slide-on thingy, you could even connect them to Wi-Fi hotspots. And out of this invitation, I became part of that mobile application design program, and I designed a location-based game for my master's thesis. And that was a wild game around a bomb that has been hidden away in the campus building of the university.
With different times, yes. Different games.
I know. Yeah, look, it's so shit, isn't it? Oh, man. Like, we need to be doing these things, you know? We need to be able to do this, but times are not allowing. This is so sad.
Yes.
It's shit. We need to be exploring everything. Anyway, so I made this game, parts social experiment, parts I want to make something that's so killer, experimental, and cool, and entertaining, and immersive. Like
just something explosive, right?
And yes, yeah. And I had a bit of an obsession with, you know, movies around bombs and how I learned to love the bomb and that kind of stuff. So, so I made this game called Mad Countdown, and which involved what you today might call alternate reality game. It had physical puzzles. It had compacts that people would use. There were saboteurs unbeknownst to the others. And there's like all kinds of physical, virtual, and overlays and in-between stuff happening. And I loved it. People were partially stressed out by the game, to be honest.
Yes.
But also people really loved it. So through people I knew at in Austin, where I had studied also in between at the ACT Lab, the Advanced Communication Technologies Lab, and there were lots of game people there who are today even and still in the game industry. I, through a friend who was there, Drew Davidson, he said, hey, why don't you apply for the experimental gameplay workshop at GDC?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, why not? And they, you know, they took me. They said, yeah. So,
yeah.
And then I traveled to GDC and this blew my mind.
Yeah.
We're talking 2001, I think, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I arrived and I remember going down the big stairway and I was like, oh, wow, here's all these freaks. This is so cool. And I'm one of them.
Yeah.
And I want to be here. This is my place. This is where I want to be. This is so cool. This is just my place. I want to be here. I'm in the brother and sisterhood of freakness and of making cool stuff that is rocking people's world. And they gave me that little slot. And then afterwards, people came to me. And you know, if you've been to GDC and then people come and appreciate what you've done and you know how much work you've put into this. And then I got to hang out with people who I was just like mind blown, like LucasArts, early people who came. This is so interesting what you're doing there, mate. You know, you want to hang out at the award ceremony and sit next to us, blah, blah. I was like, yeah, sure, why not? I was shocked. I was in shock. And then I thought, this is so good that I want to establish a game design program in Germany.
It's funny how these things somewhat are in a completely different... First of all, I need to understand if you're some kind of time traveler yourself, because all the stuff that you're actually telling me, I have no conception of like what time span we are talking about, from Rolling Stones covers to Green Party to GDC to I have no idea.
Mm.
But okay, I will give you that. All of these things happened in our timeline at some point.
Yes. There's but, no, I know what you mean. It's not a parallel world thing.
Yes.
No, it could be though.
But
I think you have enough to fill a couple of parallel universes, but
maybe
it seems to be the current timeline. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I personally haven't been to GDC because there was never the opportunity. Mm-hmm. I mean, currently kind of a bit tricky as well, although this year was possible again. Mm. But having been a part of Black Pants, and this is a mutual friend of ours, Sebastian Stamm, also a podcast guest on this podcast a few episodes ago, and actually you know each other well. So this is interesting. GDC and the IGDF showcase are such magical places in the mind of people making games.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I would say that it is still this way now, because things change and the perception changes a little bit, but I clearly remember Sebastian talking about this, like, oh yeah, and then we were at the award show, and then we were sitting next to this guy, and he's working on that stuff, and he calls it Minecraft, and like what are these kind of like timelines in which people are at? Like, so they obviously they sat next to Notch with their stupid tiny game, and it was just like crazy, and having these experiences, I hear of so many people's like first experiences at GDC, first time visiting. Also, like the industry used to be a lot smaller and a lot tighter knit, I would say. So these kind of like walking into people was just like, looking back, a lot more mind blowing. I don't know.
The thing is, I can't quite compare it, because the last time I've been to GDC, it has been, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, maybe 7 years, even longer, I think. I haven't been in a while. I would love to go back, actually, to see how things are. I mean, but look, Florian, seriously, I mean, it was back in the day. We're talking, I think this was a GDC that still took place in San Jose.
Yeah.
Not in downtown San Francisco. Yeah. So, and that even was packed.
Yeah.
And the year following, I remember they went to San Francisco, and it was packed. It was in, was it called Muscone Hall, right? I think.
Yep. And Muscone Center.
Muscone Center, yes. And so I remember walking it, and there were so many people. But as you said, it's clearly, this was one of my, initiations. Clearly. And before that, as I'd mentioned, I had been studying in Texas at the ECK Lab, where there were people who are in the game industry today still, and they were we're still been doing projects. And Drew Davidson, who I mentioned, who became my PhD supervisor, runs the Entertainment Technology Center at Carnegie Mellon University these days. And there you'll find all really cool people who are, made their stamp onto the industry, like Jesse Schell or Heather Kelly and these are people who go back to Austin, mm-hmm. not Jesse, but Heather and Drew. So there's Neil Alfonso, who was for many years was at Guerrilla Games, who I studied with, who I made my first games with in VRML, in virtual reality.
Yep.
Neil Alfonso, who's a fantastic chap, loves his tool, the tool, the band, and all that. So, so this was really an important time, and the connection between the GDC and my time at UT Austin, University of Texas at Austin, that then also led me to go back, as I said, and then say, all right, I've done this master's thing, and then I again through those people in Zurich, I think earlier I said I want to establish a game design program in Germany, but that's not true. I wanted to establish a game design program in Switzerland because we had found funds from the government. Mm-hmm. And then I did that, and I helped co-establish this with...
Is that the university that is now ZHDK?
Correct, yes. In the olden days, it was called HGKZ, a little bit of an unlucky name, knowing German history. And... the new name has been for a long time now ZHDK, and this is the program that to this day Uli Götz runs.
Yes, this is a funny connection.
Yeah, okay. So I was one of the founders, actually, before even Uli came. Gerhard Burmann and I, we did this, who for a long, long time ran the interaction design, established and ran the interaction design program there. So we did this, and then through that, I interviewed lots of people because I sort of did a feasibility study and started to learn about people in Germany who are in the game business. And and then I did that, and then it got established, and I made my first game. Also interesting story maybe is for the game design program that started out as a bachelor program, I wanted to make a game that would be advertising the program. Because mm-hmm. I thought, form and function and all that. So that'd be kind of cool. So I looked for game developers because I'm not good enough a 3D. Maybe I can model a bit in 3D and I can do other things and writing and I can, code a little bit, but not to the extent that is required to make a proper game, a 3D game. Anyway, so I was looking around for... This was also before in Switzerland there was anything like the... Pool Helvetica program that exists today, which is one of the big grant giving programs, Pool Helvetia, I think.
Pool Helvetia, yes.
Not Helvetica. Pool Helvetia. And this was prior.
It has nothing to do with font.
No. It could be, although, because it's a very good place for that.
I heard some people are anti Helvetica because it's too, common. Mm. But continue.
No. And also before there was like an IGDA chapter there, before there was the SGDA, like all those game associations, before people like Matthias Sala, who is in Switzerland, has been around for a long time, who actually, by the way, took a class that I gave at the ETH, where we designed location-based games. And then afterwards, he started out his company, Gabanga, which you might have heard of.
Yes.
So there's a connection there. But the story that I wanted to tell is that we wanted to create a game to promote and explain in a way what the game design program would be about. So I looked for people and I ran into this company, Novodex, which mm-hmm. was run by Ronald Wiemer, who also helped me write the business plan for the game design program, and this guy, Adam Morovansky. And Adam Morovansky, what they made, Novadex, was a 3D physics engine. And then they didn't have an example of what mm-hmm. a physics engine could do. So I said, why don't we throw this together and we make a game where we have a little buggy. Here's where the cars come in, by the way. Mm-hmm. And the buggy car, you steer as a player through the campus building. This is where the campus comes back in again. Mm-hmm. We let people sort of drive around and they have to pick up things mm-hmm. through proper driving, which would be the segments of the game study program, if that makes sense. Like, you know, designing for interactive environments and mathematics and whatever. Psychology, behavioral psychology, those were the components that we had in there. And you basically have to make it to the top floor. And in time, too. Because, you know, you can only study for 4 to 6 semesters. I can't recall what the specifics were. Anyhow, so Adam and I, we made this game. Now, the funny part is that, and this is how we go back. Now, today, Adam is the guy who runs Omniverse at NVIDIA. Mm-hmm. And Novadex was sold to Epic. And that component of the software component that then led to the creation of hardware chips that were physics chips is all based on the work that Novadex did at the beginning of the 2000s. And then ultimately, that's how Adam and a few other people, but mostly Adam, ended up at NVIDIA and has been integral for everything that they do in terms of physics and simulations. Like, we're talking hardcore, as you might know, hardcore, super precise 3D simulations of, you know, they can be digital twins, like they did the thing with BMW where they have a full factory to the minuscule that they do. So this is the stuff that Adam has done. And so this is also interesting to me because he's also working quite a bit with automotive these days. Hello, Adam, how are you? And so that's one of the things that we did.
Very cool. Yeah, very cool. Many timelines now coming in. And I wanted to ask you for the kind of rest of your life. I know. I know you have some things to share, the things that you care most about right now. So I wanted to open up kind of the third act here and ask you about the things you do, and you can choose, I guess, what you would like to talk about in terms of health, digital resilience, and also automotive. And I suppose feel free to draw the threads as you've been doing. That's up to you. But please, you know, I think the interesting thing that we've set up here is your deep connectedness to these topics. And I feel like the strong, it feels very organic. You know, I've never heard you tell something of, well, I wanted this and I went and got it. You know, it was more like, well, I did this and this appeared to happen in consequence. You know, there's just this, I have a pleasant feeling of organic development when I hear your story. So
thank you for saying that. And it's true because, earlier today.
You know what this is about.
I am.
You know where this is going.
Yes, I know where it's going. Look, I think this has to do with me being always following kind of an inner compass.
Yeah.
And instead of trying to be a certain person, just trying to follow that compass. I can't express it any other way. Like we could talk lots about North Star, blah, blah, blah. But look, it's just like there's topics that I feel at home with. And I've been driven by certain interests, clearly. And maybe let me span, before I get to what I'm currently doing, just very briefly span the bridge here.
Yeah.
From the time in Zurich. So we had that established. Then I went on to do my PhD at the ETH in Zurich in computer-aided architectural design, coming back to spaces, designed location-based games, something that I've mentioned earlier, a game called Rexplorer. That was a tourist exploration game, in the physical city of Regensburg in Bavaria. And that was my key project there. But I've then published books around the idea of architecture, urbanism, and games, and was the role of space, and got quite involved in academia. And then I went to Australia for a little bit with the family. I ran what was called the G-Lab, the Games and Experimental Entertainment Laboratory, for a few years. Had two labs, one in Melbourne, one in Karlsruhe. There you go again, Karlsruhe pops up. Started the BizPlay conference there, which has been running now for 10 years. We just celebrated our 10th anniversary last year. So going 11 this year, which BizPlay has always been around. Well, we started out with the gamification trope and how to connect games with business. But after a few years, I realized that I found that too limiting. And so we're really wanting to find out about games, game elements, gamefulness, creative technology, how that ties into, business, but also art, science. So I've been doing that for a few years. And after that time, now coming back to the present, after that time in Australia, we came back to Berlin in a little more than 3 years ago, because for family reasons, we had to come back, and we really love and still love Australia to this day. And I was a full professor there for a while for game design through the G Lab, and also at other places. And we did make cool new things with cars and health and well-being, worked with Big Pharma on, diabetes type 2 topics, all kinds of stuff. So I further consolidated my interest in mobility plus health plus interactive entertainment. And because I worked in different types of entertainment media, I've always tried to be open. That's why I also probably earlier said, if it's a game in the end, I don't care, really. It sounds great, but it just needs to me, respond to something that I want to achieve, right, for the audience. And maybe sometimes, yes, that's why I've done a lot of things in serious games. I like the challenge of responding to a certain type of audience that requires maybe motivation or engagement. And in health, this is a beautiful thing to see if you can help people become more active, for example. And 3 years ago, this is leading us to really truly now, without any segue into another thread, we came back to Germany, and I started work at a Volkswagen subsidiary at Diconium. And now that drives my interest today, is because, as I said earlier, I was one of the fathers, you could say, initiators of what became HoloRide, which has been celebrated. Also, they've been at South by Southwest, virtual reality, in-car virtual reality that's coupled to the ride and that kind of stuff, right? And I've done a few things around health and games for health, games for change. Ran Games for Change, by the way, in Australia and New Zealand for a few years. Organized a few conferences there. That's also part of the past. And today I am very interested in how you can bring together those things again in a new and cool way. Mobility, not just necessarily cars, but cars are a fundamental industrial sector in Germany. So, and I've always, sorry, I have to say it, I love sustainability. I've even created, as you know, guys, the Creatables Initiative, which is trying to sort of look and bring together people looking at games and experience design and to tackle sustainable development goals. So, yeah, I'm very much into that. But I'm just a stupid boy for who's out for rides and for for
hey illing, man, plus for, one plus ill, one
for illings.
Nothing wrong with it.
Illings, you know, as just being moved and moved. If it's fast, it's cool. And yes, you can simulate that. Why not? So I like race games.
Illings is a form of play. Who the, for correct. Those who don't know, from
yes, it is
the good old Homo ludens, the one no, that tumbles for, you.
No, that's no, that's Kelloir. Hmm. Roger yeah, Kelloir.
It's ah, yeah, that's right.
The other, it's the other book. It doesn't really matter. It's always these two yeah. books.
It's always these two. Yeah.
It's really two books.
It's the only time I've done true research in university, and I'm really proud of knowing this. That's why I'm doing the mm-hmm. explain boy here. And Illings, it's, the form Illings. Of play that tumbles you around. One of
correct.
The favorites.
Yes, one of my favorites too. Like, you know, no downhill skiing. We mentioned down. Everything goes downhill from here on. But so. I think that we are now living in times where, you know, mobility is just no longer just a physical question. It's a virtual question too. So when I hop around in, when I walk and I'm out in wherever, Fortnite or Roblox, I am virtually mobile, right?
Yeah.
And now I think this is a really interesting field where physical and virtual travel come together. And I'm exploring this topic for people who I work for clients, and I think there's lots of opportunity in there. And so I'm very fascinated. And I think that there's plugins, as I said, there's health. Just had gave a talk with a good friend and colleague of mine who's has got the assistant or junior professorship for gamification at the University of Erlangen-Nürnberg, Benedikt Morschhäuser, who's worked with the Tesla as Tesla suit. So a Tesla suit is basically a full body suit that you put on where you can monitor but also accentuate. Through actuators, you know, certain motions. So you walk, you wear the suit, and you walk, and then that walking is very precisely translated, for example, into VR scene.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
And so that is also a form of mobility, but different. And so exploring that, and also, of course, because I work for Volkswagen, asking the question, what could that mean for us? That's something I find extremely cool, and there's lots of stuff that can be done in that field, and maybe it's going to be tied to health and well-being. Doesn't only and exclusively have to be, of course, but I think I see an overlap there, and yeah, and so that's one thing. But the other thing that I'm really fascinated with is, as you said, resilience. And I think that resilience is, as we know, look around what's happening in the world, right? The three Ks, climate, not in English though, climate, COVID, and not in German either, but I always like calling it the three Ks because, you know, I sort of allude to, of course, the
you
other
can just spell climate and COVID with a K.
I would like to suggest that. So climate, COVID, and the word that we don't want to hear, but it's there, and it's Krieg.
Yeah.
Oh, war.
Mm-hmm. And it's war. So in German, that almost works. And these require that we... And I think also specifically in Germany that we develop, that we learn resilience in school. That would be the German way to respond it. Mm-hmm. Let's make it the class. Yes. Textbook. Give me the textbook. Where's the model? Let's talk about the definition of resilience. What do you mean, Stefan, exactly by that? And I would say, but I can tell you, I came across this group of Dutch game developers called Bad News a few years ago, and they had made a game that made me laugh so hard. It really made me laugh. It was a very quick game, maybe 5 minutes, 7 minutes game, browser-based, no authentication required, called Bad News. So I played that, And in Bad News, you play the villain, the evil guy.
Uh-huh.
And I really liked that. I thought, this is fantastic. And you play the game and you're are tasked. And it's still out there. Go play, I think, go play Bad News. Or, I mean, the company website is badnews.eu.
Yeah, we will link to it please. The show notes. And
actually, they've just changed the name to Tilt Studios. So they are now called TILT, all capital letters, Tilt Studios. Anyhow.
So the game is at getbadnews.com. Getbadnews.
Mm-hmm. And there's other games out there. Go Viral, which is about COVID. And one is called Harmony Square. I think Breaking Harmony Square. Fantastic game. And I contributed to these games. Did writing and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. So we're a good team. Really good team. So Bad News, I played the game and it left. And it loved it because in the game, you're tasked to destroy villages and communities by spreading disinformation. And being the most villainous person spreading fake news and polarizing and just wrecking it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what we love about games, don't we? Sometimes. And what I really loved about the games was that they were clearly meant to be entertaining. And when we started out, Florian, you said, serious games guy. And I said, not so much, or maybe not exclusively.
Yeah.
yeah. All good. But this was one of the first serious games that I saw that were just putting entertainment first.
Mm-hmm.
And if I've learned anything, then if you touch serious games and they don't entertain, then just don't do it. It has to be that way. And yes, we want to evoke deep feelings. That's one of the holy grails of game design, is like make people cry, make them feel so immersed, make them, you know, scare them. I know. But to me, after many years of having done this, I always, many times I thought, even in my games and the things that we did, like, oh, this is just not entertaining enough. So I think, and they did that. And also with the nice little move of you play the bad guy, you know, this is great. Yeah. So plus they had the University of Cambridge, who used the games to show how such a behavioral intervention could affect what they call a cognitive vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
That afterwards, after playing the game, which they've shown many, many times now with different types of games, actually makes people more aware of disinformation and less likely to be using and spreading disinformation. So, and just the spirit of these people, I invited people to Ruud Oosterwoud, who's the one of the founders and the key, used to be the key maker. He's not so present there anymore.
Where are they based?
They're based in Den Haag.
Mm-hmm.
And they're growing. They get a lot of attention right now in the Dutch national media. Really lots.
Yeah.
Because to reveal this, I mean, we've been working. And I am there as what is a good word to describe what I do there? I'm like I'm the old fart.
The elder.
Thank you for saying that.
The wise, the elder. Spiritual counsel.
Yes, it's kind of, I think it's kind of true. So I love these guys. They're so funny and they're so spirited and they're wonderful and they're really trying to make a change in the world. And I think that we are doomed because the echo chambering that is the internet is so much pushing us apart in understanding what is really authentic information. Mm-hmm. I find it a key attack point for democracy too.
Yes.
And I want to see this defended. And that's one of the reasons, you know, 2 years ago, we sort of sat together and I said, can I be part of this? I would love to. And so I've been helping on and off. And so they've been actually hired by, you know, the US Department of State and the UK government and the EU Commission and others and the WHO, World Health Organization, to build stuff that prevents and dissects disinformation making.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I think this is really important. And resilience is the key, digital resilience. That's why we're doing this, or information resilience, because, this is going to be a thing.
Hmm. I also want to put one thing on top of that. So one of the interesting concepts that I sometimes think about is anti-fragility, which is the which is coined by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, and it basically means getting stronger under pressure. So the core thesis is like, for those who haven't heard about this, is like, what's the opposite of fragile?
Yep.
Then maybe you would say robust, but then he says that's not true, because when you have a glass and you drop it, it shatters, so it disintegrates. And when you have a sturdy box full of books and you drop it, nothing happens. But nothing happening is not the opposite of disintegrating, because the opposite of disintegrating and shattering would be like becoming stronger. You know, it's not just nothing happens, but the opposite, which is stronger. And he coins that as anti-fragility and makes a good case for humans, the human system, the human body, the human itself, being one of the, and the human body, I don't know if I just said that, as one of the core things that are anti-fragile. Hint towards, you know, any type of fitness, you know, you put stress, or any type of challenge, more broadly speaking, you put stress on a human, and he or she will usually, not crumble under pressure, but like have some trouble and then emerge stronger.
Yes.
And I think the way you, because you asked in the beginning, for jokingly, for the definition of resilience, I think anti-fragility is really important. You know, like for me personally, I consume a lot of crazy information in all types of directions because I think it's extremely funny, and I feel very anti-fragile. You know, and I seek the percentages of truth everywhere, which is now the new skill. So maybe that's just my opinion or my take on it, or maybe a bit of inspiration for you guys. And what I automatically quickly think when you tell the story about this game and what they do is like, consider anti-fragility, you know, because I think we're moving into a world where you can't just be resilient against information. You know, it's not the game or the literacy that will be required in the future is not to discern which information is correct, because all information contains things that are true and that are false. It's kind of this path of the middle thing. And it's also, you know, kind of the status of the information giver and blah, 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 blah. So, so resilience itself is good. I would say anti-fragility, or maybe it means the same, might be even better, you know. It's like, well, consume and digest all the information and learn how to do that and let them, you know, not disintegrate you. Be resilient at the very least, and then, you know, maybe digest them and become stronger from this challenging, let's say, information, misinformation, weird information, you know, in these, because it's all an in-between state now. Like, there's no clear narrative, no clear storyline. Yeah, that's my little take on it that I felt like I wanted to get rid of.
But very important, if I may chime in, because indeed, there is no one. Well, let's put it this way: when you read about resilience and you go to, say, people who come out of material science, resilience, that means you've got, I don't know, like a metal rig, and you bend it and then it will go back because the metal that you've used is allowing for that into the original state. I would say that the conservative reading of resilience is that you go back to the original state. And there has been quite some discussion in sort of people who look at resilience as, yes, the fundamental principle that might be a driver even of humanity being able to live in the very cold and the very hot under certain conditions. Maybe that is one of the things, right? There's a second school that then says resilience or I know the concept of anti-fragility, or I'm aware of it, means that you convene the original state with something you learn and then you adapt. Mm-hmm. And there's something new that comes out of that.
Yeah. And there's
innovation coming out of that. There's reinvention coming out of that. And I prefer that notion. I don't want to go, because then otherwise there's a school that reads resilience also almost like a preserve current state against attack from the outside. And we can't do this. We need to move on. This is, again, what I've said a few sentences ago, is like, I believe that resilience is, it's almost like an evolutionary factor.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
And so
also adaptation.
That's exactly. So it's really about adaptation and not going back to status quo. Now, the question becomes, of course, with the current situation, where are we headed with the 3Ks, you know? What is anti-fragility there? You know, I want to know what you guys think. I mean, for a while I mentioned Creatables. We thought, if we use games and we look at digital as a way of, finding innovations, that will help us, equip ourselves and change also lifestyles, in the face of the climate catastrophe. I think there's lots of stuff that can be done, and it's kind of almost alleviated in a way by the war, because, you see how we're not fully, but, people are looking at alternative forms of electricity making, which is good. So there's always it's kind of shit to say this in a way, but it feels not right. But I have to say it, there's always good in the bad.
No. And I think I really like that we're ending on this, because that is anti-fragility, or if you want to combine two terms in your language, resilience and adaptation. And I think that that's exactly it. And keyword, we need to move on. I think it's good to stop here, because we won't have more time to get into your question, which is, of course, a question that everybody is invited to ponder. And maybe for us to discuss another time. And maybe, kind of what I wanted to ask you about is something like vision and what we, like your future vision, because we went into the past, into the present. Maybe there's a look ahead, and we kind of have something for that, because we end this podcast with essential questions that we like. Some are more general, some are more... about games and the industry, and it's a little game, it's a little quick fire round, more or less, and it should land us on a good ending note. So if you're ready to play that game with us, then I would start.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so let me ask you this. And why are these, did the order change? I'm confused. My first question is always...
Is that already a question, Simon?
No, I just got confused by by the data in front of me. No, the first question is always the very simple but not easy question of what is the purpose of your being?
Love.
Nice. I can... That's so good. Love. Very good. What inspires you?
My family.
What is a beautiful day to you?
Sun, stuff that interests me intellectually, stuff that takes me away from intellectualism, and music making. And hanging out with friends and family. Good food, of course.
Of course. I was going to ask. Okay, and here's that. So what is the change you want to see in the world?
That we all realize that we're brothers and sisters.
How do you contribute to it?
I try to do my thing in my work.
if you would start a new save game in your life right now, or like a new game plus, what occupation would your new character have?
Wizard healer.
Nice. And last one from me. Do you have books that you often recommend or that you maybe like to gift to people? One or two or three?
Ooh. Einstein's Dreams. Cool book for game designers and everyone who designs for alternate worlds. It's kind of a biography of Einstein, but explained in a way that they talk about different forms of space and time in every chapter. Like sometimes space doubles and stretches, sometimes it shrinks, and at the same time, time does something. It's amazing. I love it. Einstein's Dreams. Books that are really apart from that. Let me think of a second book. I'm just turning around here to look at one of the piles that I've got here, and something that I've read recently.
Oh, everybody should have at least one of those piles.
Ooh, pooh. Well, a comic. We haven't talked about graphic novels and comics because I love comics. Mm. I collect them. Maybe Lock and Key because it's just sitting here. And don't watch the series. Read the books.
I've been refraining from doing it.
Yes, don't do it. There's so many books that have been, of course, made into movies, and don't. Lock and Key, the comics. Fantastic writing, fantastic drawing, beautiful. Love it. And so if you love Lovecraft, well, you'll love Lock and Key. And I love Lovecraft. That's it.
I love craft.
Okay, so these two or one more?
This is a really good vegan cookbook that we're using at the moment called, I think, Loop.
Okay.
Vegan fast food. Oh, it has so many really good dishes in there. So if you eat less meat, cook more out of that cookbook.
Dude, a cookbook? Sure. I love it. We never had
That's a first.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. That's nice. So good. Actually going to look this up.
Okay. So here we go with the next batch of questions. What are your favorite games? Similar type of question, but with another medium.
Ooh. No one has ever asked me this question before, and I've been so long.
What? Is that true?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, maybe
nobody has ever
breaking grounds.
Maybe what are you playing right now at the moment? But okay, I'll list a few that come to my mind, all right? So, Boulder Dash.
Mm-hmm.
Unreal Tournament.
Mm-hmm.
God of War.
All right.
Gran Turismo. Katamari Damashi.
Usually ask for 1, 2, 3.
So oh, I'm sorry.
No.
It's fine,
please.
It's fine.
I want to hear more.
Rez. Oh, God, what have I played recently? These are old games, really. Let me think. I've played a bit of Destiny 2, which I kind of like, but it's not probably my favorite, not at all. Not close. Pokemon Go.
Here we go.
Of course. Too many.
Yes. Too many for this question.
Yeah. Let's stop here. Let's stop. I'll go on and on forever, probably.
It was so already a great
all of them are good. All of them are badges in my life.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, like and there are some that took me, and even small, unnamed, Untitled Goose Game is a funny game because I know the guys. I love Heavenly Bodies as a recent game because they were made by friends of mine. Which you might have played, the physics crazy cosmonauts game. So this is a game that's so difficult to play, but I love that idea. making it so hard to play the game. And it has this beauty to it, this poetry of being out there and out and exploring and bound to those rules. And then it's a really cool game. Heavenly Bodies. It's on Steam and on PlayStation.
All right. Who is somebody from the games industry who you would like to get to know?
Ooh. I think I don't want to meet anyone.
And then I was at that place and I met that person and now we're doing that and that. And then at this point, I don't want to meet any more people.
I mean, that's shit to say because I'm open-minded. I love meeting people, but I have I am curious.
Yeah.
But I have learned, if I may say this, if I have learned and when I... You can approach people in the game industry usually are very approachable, right?
Yes.
But most of them are also kind of, special. And I have a t-shirt that says, Mom says I'm special. And there's this little cute ape on it that looks totally bizarre. So I don't know why. I have learned that people are not usually what the work they have done is, if that makes sense.
Yes. Oh, next time we meet, I will talk to you about this more.
Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why I am not so interested in people, unless I want to really, really learn from them. And that's what I love, but I am more interested in the work.
All right.
Because in music, people are usually crazy in the head. And because they express what no one dares to say.
Yeah.
In games, people express worlds that are not there yet, as we've discussed at length. And that does say a lot about them already.
Yeah.
So unless we share something as in, shared tastes in music or in games or in what have you, which usually is the way, I am happy if I can just hang out with really good friends of mine and that's it, and who are not in games and media and entertainment.
Nice. I like how you can clearly see that you are some kind of game designer because you broke the design of this mini game and you just went by a mechanic. I won't reveal it. You have to listen to other episodes how it works, but you're like a speedrunner who found a bug in my question. Who is someone you know who you think we should have on this podcast?
Heather Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
She is fantastic. She's done so many things. She's now an assistant professor at Carnegie Mellon. She's done early sex games, but challenging the notion of what sexuality can mean, be in games. She's done also anti-disinformation stuff at Carnegie Mellon. She did really groundbreaking PlayStation games early on, lived in Austin for a long time, knew and was part of the game studio scene there, with Spectre and those people. So Heather is awesome. Started the Women in Games initiative at IGDA. Mm-hmm. Many reasons. She's cool.
And the last one, where can people find you? And don't reveal your physical location.
No, I won't.
We've had some mutual friends who might have done this sometime previously. Uh-huh.
I have stopped being on Twitter, to be honest. I mean, I still have an account. My handle is Playbe, Playbe in one word. I, to be honest, live on LinkedIn mostly for business reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a few talks about resilience or interviews with people, but that kind of stopped. So, yeah, I'm boring that way, I think. I'm not much of an influencer, I think, and I don't care, really. I care about my family and games and cool stuff, like good entertainment. That's really it.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you this? And this might also not stick. I can see your very reasonable essentialism, like protectiveness, but as an explorer, what type of treasures slash types of people maybe, or people with certain games to play and to invite you to, would you love to find in your in your inbox?
Is that That's something awesome. That... Oh, yeah, thank you for saying, for asking these questions. Now I see. Oh, yes, please. Email me.
About anything.
About anything?
About games that are special and that take a new twist and turn. Look, we've got so many cool things happening with A Maze, where, you know, Weidemann sort of challenged, opened the space to arts, to inviting in indie games. We've got Indie Arena Booth, which is so beautiful and fantastic to be there. These are places that I find super interesting, and yes, where I might be hanging out. There's game stuff in Melbourne happening what is it called? Hoover, I think, Hoover Dam or something, where they try out location-based games, physical games. There's always stuff popping up, you know, and this is where I'm super interested in this kind of stuff. I also hang out at art stuff. Like, I've just been to an underground arts exhibition in Berlin where they and the place is going to be torn down. So there's an art collective who installed, I think, 14 interactive, partially just weird stuff in a kind of a, I think it's a former Melzerei. You know, like a beer brewing a facility, and it's underneath, underground, huge, large. And so I just went there and I saw this really beautiful thing, which was like a kind of a tent where that was projected upon, and it sort of evoked and 300 degree sort of immersive thingy where it evoked a storm in a Scottish storm, because the artist is a Scottish woman, and so this was like her thing, and I really love the notion of being protected but being underneath, but it had this force, this ferocity of a storm, right? Really, really, it came across, and it really made me think about how we are, in a way, should be connecting to nature, how we kind of have lost that connection in many ways. That made me think about virtuality and what that really does to us. It made me think about how we are currently in a storm because of all these, because of the 3Ks and what it means to be sheltered and to be safe. And this is places that I love. So if you've got something like that, then you can email me.
At?
spw@playbee.com.
Nice. Well, that's nice. Thank you, man, for this amazing journey of an episode. I was thoroughly entertained, and I am one of the hosts of this podcast. Maybe.
Thank you.
Maybe that's actually a good reason to do this type of thing. Huh?
Thank you. I want to thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. And Florian, you know what to do. You know what we need to do next.
Yes, I know what we need to do next. Thank you very much, Stefan.
Yes,
for coming on, for sharing your wisdom, for taking us to explore with you. I was wondering where this was going. We really veered off our usual structure and just wanted to go into this theme of exploring together with you, since that's your title. So thank you for taking us on this journey, and thanks for being with us.
Pleasure.
Until next time.
Until the next time.
Until the next time. Goodbye, Stefan. Goodbye, Florian. Goodbye, everybody. See you next time. Hi there, Simon here. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you like what you hear here and you would like to hear more here, feel free to follow or to subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you get your audio fix. We appreciate you, and we promise you to bring you many more insightful conversations with fantastic games industry guests from Berlin and from all over Europe. Thank you very much, and see you very soon. Bye-bye.
Hi there. Before you go, this is Florian, project manager for GamesNet Berlin Europe. If you want to stay connected to the network, find out more about upcoming events and links to other MediaNet initiatives, you can visit us at gamesnetberlin.eu and subscribe to our newsletter. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast, and until next time.